seen that talk and want to go elsewhere, this is fair warning. My name is Neil Nathu, and this is Peter Grehan. We are going to talk about Beehive, which is a native FreeBSD hypervisor. This is work that we have been doing in NetApp. So Beehive is a BSD hypervisor. The name stands for a BSD hypervisor. It is a type 2 hypervisor, also commonly known as a hosted hypervisor. So if you are familiar with VMware workstation running on Windows, then you already know what a hosted hypervisor is. The difference in the case of Beehive is that FreeBSD is the host operating system. There's some good news on the availability of the source code. NetApp has decided to release the source code under a BSD license. And as of 1:30 today morning, a snapshot against 8.1 is in the projects branch under Beehive underscore ref. And the other thing I want to stress is that even though we have made a significant amount of progress until this point, this is definitely a work in progress. A lot of things still need to be done. And now that the code is out there for the community to look at and contribute, hack away at it. So let's get right to the status. I guess that's what most of you will be interested in, what it can do. As far as the guest is concerned, we can boot 64-bit FreeBSD, and we have tested it with releases 7.2 and 8.1. We fully expect other releases to work as well. It's just that we haven't tested it. SMP is fully functional, and we have tested 1, 2, 4, and 8 virtual CPUs. We support two types of I/O: Vert I/O, which is a paravirtualized device specification that was introduced in LGUEST and was made popular by KVM. We also support PCI pass-through for workloads that require the performance or that have devices that do not have paravirtualized front ends. One thing to note here is that we do require some minor kernel patches on the guest side, and I have a slide that talks a bit more about that. But the point I want to stress in this slide is that the kernel patches are not a function of any design decision we made in the hypervisor. They were pretty much done for the sake of getting things up and running fairly quickly. On the host side, we have tested with 64-bit FreeBSD running 8.1, and again, we expect other releases to work as well. In fact, we are in the process of porting our changes from 8.1 to head. You do not need any modifications to the host kernel to get the hypervisor functionality. All of that is provided by the kernel module. On the hardware side, Beehive is picky about what hardware it runs on, so it requires virtualization assist, either VTX or AMDV. And more specifically, it requires nested page tables. We depend on that support, and that's what made developing Beehive a much easier task than the previous hypervisors, than the hypervisors that are already present. Intel VTX is fully supported, and work is in progress on AMDV. So if somebody's interested in working on providing support for AMDV, that would be a most welcome contribution. So I want to spend just a very short amount of time on this slide, just so that everybody is clear what we are talking about. If you are familiar with KVM's model of virtualization, this should be no surprise to you. At the bottom, you have the host operating system, which in the case of Beehive is FreeBSD. This is the kernel module, which is Beehive, that provides the virtualization capabilities that talks to the processor hardware assist and enables us to run guest VMs. On the top in user space, you have your typical your host applications, and you can also run, by virtue of the hypervisor module, a guest operating system, and the guest operating system has in turn kernel and user. The operating system runs in kernel space, applications run in user space. So no surprises here, I hope. So this is the implementation of Beehive. So let me walk you through this. In the middle of the slide, the horizontal line is the customary user-kernel separation. In the kernel, you have vmm.ko, which is the kernel module that provides the virtualization capabilities. The kernel module itself has two halves. The top half is processor independent. It's mostly, it has everything to do with interfacing with FreeBSD. So it will provide ioctl support for the user space to be able to configure the VM, to control the VM. It has memory management to allocate memory to virtual machines or reclaim memory from virtual machines when they are destroyed. And it also has APIC emulation. Both VTX and AIM, you know, VTX has a limited APIC emulation support, but we found it much easier to just do it once for both AMD and Intel in the processor-independent part. The bottom part of vmm.ko is the processor-specific virtualization assist. So right now we have the bottom part for Intel VTX, and the AMD V should just plug in there. And so popping back up into user space, you have the VM run process. This is the process that is configuring and then controlling the virtual machine. And it has two main functions. The first one is to provide an execution context. So you see the host threads in the VM run process. They provide an execution context to run the guest instructions. So the way I've tried to signify that in this picture is the color of the host threads matches the color of the virtual CPUs. So each host thread will provide a context in the host to execute guest instructions. The other main functionality of the VM run process is to do I/O emulation. And there's two major types. One is the legacy I/O, which is something that was inherited with the PC architecture. So you have your RTC, your legacy interrupt controller, the programmable timer, and even modern operating systems assume the existence of those I/O devices. So we have to have device models that emulate accesses to those devices. But more importantly, we have the VertIO block and the VertIO net backends. So these are the paravirtualized device backends that the guest uses to get access to the network interface, a virtual network interface, or a virtual block device. And finally, I always forget this because it happens so transparently, which is the nested page tables and the guest address translations. So the way that works is when memory is allocated to a virtual machine, host memory is allocated to a virtual machine, we create a nested page table that translates from a guest physical address to the host physical address. And once we instantiate that in the virtual machine's control block, that's all we need to do. The hardware does all of the heavy lifting of converting from a guest linear address to a guest physical address to a host physical address. So, and that's the reason why it kind of lives on its own side. So we can come back to this picture. I mean, there's a lot that I can talk here, but depending on the time and the type of questions I get, we can come back to this picture. So digging a little bit deeper into some components of Beehive, for CPU virtualization, like I alluded to earlier, we do require hardware support for virtualization. Most of the instructions that the guest execute natively on the processor. We try very hard not to get in the way of the guest instructions. However, we do need to trap into the hypervisor for a variety of instructions. I have some examples up there. If you do MSR accesses, we access the local APIC using MSRs to emulate that. We have to trap into the hypervisor anytime the guest accesses the local APEC through an MSR. Any ins and outs are trapped by the hypervisor and shipped up to user space, where we saw the I/O emulation block. CPU ID is something that unconditionally traps into the hypervisor. And the final two, the halt and pause, are the instructions that we trap to be more friendly with the host scheduler. So when the guest executes a halt, we take it as an indication that it is idle, and we allow the host scheduler to schedule some other host thread if it wants to on that CPU. And of course, hardware interrupts. Hardware interrupts are always vectored through the host's IDT and never through the guest's IDT. We do inject virtual interrupts through the guest's IDT, but hardware interrupts always trap into the hypervisor. The local APIC is, like I said earlier, the local APIC is emulated. FreeBSD uses memory mapped I/O. FreeBSD head, as well as all the previous releases, use memory mapped I/O to access the local APIC. We thought that emulating MMIO instructions, trapping on MMIO instructions and emulating them, would be more difficult, given that there is not enough support from the hardware to do that. However, for MSR accesses, there is excellent support, and it's an atomic instruction. You get told exactly what you want to write, where you want to write it. So we had a patch in the guest to access the local APIC using the X2 APIC mode. So that's one of the patches that I mentioned earlier. The startup EP is interesting. Most of the EPs that are sent from one virtual CPU to another virtual CPU are dealt with in the kernel. So that's the fast path. The startup EP is special because in a real processor, a startup EP would be sent by the bootstrap processor to the application processor, and then it would start running. In the case of a virtual machine, there is no real application processor. Instead, what we have is a host thread context that runs the virtual CPU. So we let the startup AP go all the way up to user space, create a new thread, which then gets us the host context, which then comes back into the kernel and starts executing guest instructions. All right, memory virtualization, this is simple. We took the easy way out. We said we won't support any processor that does not have nested page tables, because the literature that I read on supporting shadow page tables was too intimidating. So we require nested page tables, and they do the translation from guest physical to host physical. There is another simplification that we did, which is that memory is... when you make a request for memory allocation to a virtual machine, either you get it or you don't. We don't try to do allocate on demand, or we don't try to share memory between virtual machines. And that makes setting up the nested page tables a very easy thing. You set it up once, you associate it with the virtual machine, and you're done. It also makes PCI pass-through a whole lot easier, because essentially you can replicate the nested page tables to the IOMMU page tables. In fact, you can share those page tables. We haven't done it yet, but it's possible to share the nested page tables and the IOMMU page tables. And the third bullet is something we did out of caution. We did not want the host... Okay, we certainly don't want one VM to mess around with the memory belonging to another VM. But we also did not like the idea that the host could trample all over memory belonging to random VMs. So we try to hide the... We actually do hide the memory that's allocated to the virtual machines from the host. And there's a couple of ways to do that. You can either restrict it as a kernel config option. When you build the kernel, you can say, I don't care how much real memory is on the system, I only want the host to see the first 2 gigs or something like that. Or you can do it at boot time using a tunable. All right, so PCI virtualization, we emulate the PCI bus as well as config space accesses in user space. And we have two types of devices on the virtual PCI bus. One is VirtIO, which is a paravirtualized device, and the other is PCI pass-through, which is, as the name suggests, it means that the guest gets direct access of the PCI function. And I have slides to talk about both, so I won't spend time here. The other simplifying decision that we made during the development was to do interrupt delivery through MSI only. And the reason for that is legacy interrupt delivery requires emulation of the IO APIC, and that's something we would rather not do at the beginning. And MSIX is hard because that would require us to trap on accesses to the bar where the vectors are configured and emulate the instructions. And again, that's something we tried as much as possible not to do. That's not to say it cannot be done or that it's not desirable. It's just that to get things rolling and working, we chose MSI. Both single vector and multi-vector MSI are supported, and it seems to work. It seems to most of the devices that support MSIX also support MSI, so it's not a big deal. So VirtIO, it's a paravirtualized device specification. It was first introduced in LGEST, and it was made very popular by KVM. There's a paper that describes the VirtIO. It's not a specification, but there's a paper that describes the structures and the rings that VirtIO uses. The front-end drivers in FreeBSD were posted to FreeBSD Current in January of 2011. Unfortunately, we have not been able to get the author to release them under a BSD license. So we are using them internally, and you could use them internally. They are out there publicly accessible. I don't think we can commit them to the source code just yet, but that's getting sorted out. Both Peter and Doug are in touch with the author, so hopefully that gets resolved quickly. The backend VirtIO net and VirtIO block devices, if you remember the implementation slide, you had the user space process, and I had two blocks that showed where the backend devices were implemented. So the VirtIO net uses the tab device to send and receive Ethernet frames on behalf of the guest. And VirtIO block simply opens a file in the host's file system and reads and writes, and just calls read and write on it on behalf of the guest when it wants to read and write blocks on the guest file system. PCI pass-through, I'm running out of time. I want to leave time for questions, so I won't spend a lot of time on this. As the name suggests, PCI pass-through is the guest has direct control of the PCI function, and the cases where you would want to use this is where you need the performance, or if you have some weird PCI device for which there is no paravirtualized interface. We also support Intel VTT, which you need to. So Intel VTT is Intel's IOMMU technology, and you need to do that. You need to support that so that DMA transfers from the device are mapped correctly to the virtual machine's memory regions. If there are more questions, I can come back to this, but I want to cover my slide deck. So guest modifications, we have a custom console and debug port. It was purely done just to get up and running quickly. We did not have a 16550 device emulation. We still don't have that. But once that's there, you don't need this modification anymore. Local APIC access is through X2 APIC MSRs. And I think this is a change that should go into FreeBSD regardless. I don't think this is specific to Beehive. Real machines also support X2 APIC, so this could go into FreeBSD head just as is. And the final change was, this was interesting. There's some processors that do support nested page tables, but that do not support real mode guest execution. So this was a problem in the AP bring up, because the AP bring up starts with a 16-bit real mode, transitions to 32-bit mode, transitions to compatibility, and then 64-bit mode. So it has to go through a bunch of jumps from one mode to another. So for processors that do not support real mode execution, we were left with the option of emulating real mode instructions, which, as you probably have figured out by now, we don't like to do. The other option was we could have a 64-bit trampoline which went all the way up to user space, and then when it came back down, the AP would directly start executing in 64-bit mode. And again, this modification is needed only on processors that do not support real mode guest execution. If you have a more recent processor like an Intel Sandy Bridge that supports real mode, and you should be fine. User space API, a virtual machine, when you create a virtual machine, it will appear in your file system as a device node, and you can issue ioctls to it to control it and configure it. And I have some examples here. We have about 20 ioctls, and they are what you might suspect. You set a register, you try to allocate memory, you can pin a virtual CPU to a host CPU in cases where you want to partition your system and not really share resources. You can inject a virtual interrupt into the guest, and you can get statistics, things like that. The other interesting thing is, because it's a device node, we could choose to implement read, write, and mmap on top of it. And this is very useful when debugging. So if you want to dump the contents of, let's say the virtual machine is in some weird state, you can send it a sig stop, get all the virtual CPUs to stop, and essentially get a snapshot of its execution state. And then you can dump the memory contents of the VM and see if you can debug whatever problem it was having. And performance, I won't go through the slide. I only have 5 minutes. But the performance looks all right. I did a test with Make Build World, and I have 3 configurations, bare metal, which is bare metal. There's no virtualization. There's partitioned, in which the host and the guest are not sharing any resources. And we can do that using CPU set to restrict the host to a set of CPUs and the guest to a set of CPUs. Memory is already separate. And if you use PCI pass-through to the guest, then you're not even sharing I/O. So that's about a 1% increase in the build time compared to bare metal. And finally, virtualize, where you're using Word I/O backends for both network and block devices. And you're letting the host scheduler schedule the virtual CPUs in any way that it wants to. And the overhead in that case is about 9% with the build times. So future opportunities, there's lots of future opportunities to make changes to this, to improve this. One of the biggest ones is we need to support other guest operating systems. So Windows, Linux, other BSD variants, we need to have support for that. AMD's hardware virtualization assist needs to be done. It's an important feature, and we need to have that. There are some workloads which require suspending and resuming guests or live migration, so it would be nice to have, but I'm told it's very difficult to do. And finally, biosimulation. I should have put that as the first thing, because I believe that if we need to boot Windows without any modifications, then we would need some kind of a biosimulation. So that's what I have, and I ran through some slides quickly. So if you want me to go back, I can talk about that.
I was wondering about when you talk about you can support 1 through 8 CPUs. Can you support more CPUs than your host has CPUs? In other words, can you essentially virtualize your CPUs? It hasn't been given thought to things like supporting 64 CPUs that could run in a 4 CPU box for testing purposes, defined timing bugs, etc.
So not explicitly, but we do have a mode of execution in which all the virtual CPUs can run on a single host thread. And we have tested 8 virtual CPUs running on a single host thread. So we haven't given any thought to M virtual CPUs mapped to N host threads. We haven't done that. But we have this model of either N to 1 or 1 to 1.
Said that
you have to specify ahead of time that you're going to set aside such memory for.
That's right. That's one thing. The other thing with PCI pass-through is with, if you are using pass-through devices, you also have to set aside what PCI devices you want to use as pass-through devices for the guest. So that's the upfront configuration you would need.
Do you need to set that at boot time with the host?
It's tunable. The pass-through devices are tunable, and the memory separation, it can either be a kernel config option using MaxMem, or it can be a tunable using hardware.fismem.
But it's still done at boot time. You can't decide after 3 minutes and 3 hours, oh, I need to start another.
Right. Not right now. But I believe it can be done.
Do you know what needs to be done?
I think we just need to grab a bunch of physical pages from the host and somehow...
So there's not a requirement that we all contiguous in physical memory?
It's not a requirement, but it would be good for performance reasons to have contiguous physical memory, because then you can map it using large pages. Sandy Bridge supports 1 gig pages. So if you have a 4 gig machine, you can pretty much satisfy your VM. With 4 TLB entries, you can map your VM, which is very attractive. But it's not a requirement that it needs to be contiguous. There was a question from here. I did not do any comprehensive performance testing. This is the only thing I have. So this gives you an idea of... So this is bare metal, and this is with a VertIO network and a VertIO block. And it's a make-build world, so it's using both the network because the source is mounted on NFS, and it's using block because the object directory is on the block device. And this is a 9% increase in the time, but I can't tell you exactly what to take from these numbers. Oh, right. So we were using an in-house bootloader for our development, which we unfortunately could not share with the community. But Doug Rapson, in the short amount of time, has ported FreeBSD's bootloader to user space. And I'm in the process of gluing that with Beehive. So hopefully we'll have, before the end of the conference, we might have a bootloader. All right.
Yeah. You have those various commands, IOPTools you can do. Do they include IOPTools that can be used on a GDB stub so that you can single step the virtual machine?
On a GDB stub? I'm not sure exactly.
Can you use BDP to debug a virtualized system?
Absolutely, yes.
How does it do that?
We have the debug port. So we have a console port and a debug port. So you can attach KGDB to the debug port. The standard way you would...
Is this using the decons?
No, it's just two I/O ports that we picked that were not being used for anything.
So you use a standard GDB server protocol, yeah?
Yeah. And there's no modifications in GDB. The GDB stub talks over this I/O port when it wants to read or write. That's all.
So do you have the GDB modifications to have to talk to that?
You don't need GDB modifications for that.
Standard GDB network protocol. GDB opens a port.
When you say port, I was thinking in terms of, out byte, in byte. You're talking about a socket port.
Yeah. No, not really.
You present that, okay. From the GDB stubs point of view, it's out byte and in byte. However, that out byte and in byte is translated to a network port, to a socket that GDB can connect to. So when you do an out byte from the GDB stub, it goes all the way up to user land, which then results in a write on a socket on which the GDB, KGDB is running. So that makes it very easy to debug. As long as you have network connectivity on the host, you can connect GDB to it. Okay, just 2 minutes over time. All right. Thank you. for the loader plug. So, oh.
Too bright, man.
It's on.
Okay.
Think that'll be fine?
Yeah, it's moving a little bit.
Yeah. Okay.
There,
even better. Your eyes are glistening.
I did appear in a couple of operas once.
Okay, so my name is John Baldwin, and this is not quite a long talk. So feel free to interrupt with questions, and at the end there'll be some kind of open questions. And if I have time, I have a shorter talk from earlier today that I might also try to fit in. So we'll just see how far we go. So this talk is about something I've been working off and on for over a year. And it's some changing away a bit of how we do interrupt threads in our current kernel. So the primary reason that I've kind of done this work that I'll describe in a bit is several years ago we added a new feature to our interrupt threads called interrupt filters. We kind of previously interrupts in FreeBSD, you could register two different types of interrupt handlers. They could run in two different contexts. The first context is, to pick an arbitrary name, I'll call it primary interrupt context. It's where you would, as soon as the CPU interrupts, the kind of context it places you in. Normally interrupts are disabled in the CPU. There's a very limited number of things you can do, like take a spin lock, but hardly anything else. The other interrupt context that FreeBSD provides is that we actually will have a whole thread context that you can run your interrupt handler in. And by default, most interrupts run in this threaded context. Interrupt filters is a way to allow a single driver to use both of those at the same time. And it's design we borrowed from OS X, but it's also used in other operating systems such as Windows, where filters are effectively mandatory and iThreads are somewhat optional. So the idea of interrupt filters was if you have a shared interrupt and you have several devices sharing the interrupt, if the devices all registered a filter, they could decide when an interrupt occurred if their threaded handler should run or not based on whether or not they claimed the interrupt. But it was also used for other things such as working around broken Intel host bridges, causing aliased interrupts from E1000 devices showing up on USB controllers. But when interrupt filters went in, one of the design decisions was, well, if we have an interrupt filter, we're going to require that the interrupt filter manage the interrupt state of the hardware so we can avoid having to mask the interrupt in the PIC, such as the IOA PIC or the 8259A. And in the case that it does that, we don't actually need to mask that PIC at all, and we can give that interrupt handler a dedicated iThread that doesn't share the iThread with other interrupt handlers that don't have a filter. However, in the case of a shared interrupt, that would mean that potentially you could schedule multiple threads when an interrupt occurred. And we decided we didn't want to do this. We also assumed, perhaps incorrectly, that in general, if you had shared interrupts, the interrupt would probably be level triggered. And so if both devices interrupted at the same time, if the first one had a filter, we would schedule that thread and it would run. But the interrupt would reassert, and on the second assertion, we would let the second device run, and the second interrupt handler would get a chance to be scheduled, and so both interrupts would still run that way. However, in practice, it turns out on some architectures, it doesn't quite work out. I don't recall all the details. I know Marcel was one of the ones who pointed out cases where it doesn't work. But as a result of that, we have this code that's been in the tree for several years, and it's not turned on. And I want to either turn it on and fix it or get rid of it. I don't want to be in this weird limbo state.
So one of the primary motivations for these changes is I wanted to fix it so we could turn this on by default finally. A second motivation is Jeff Roberson did some interesting work at a vendor to allow a kind of cooperative scheduling among interrupt handlers for NICs. And I wanted to provide some generalized underpinnings inside of interrupt threads that you could be used to build that, not just for NICs, but for other devices if it was desired as well. I also wanted to allow you to have more freedom to kind of reorganize how we bind threads and interrupt handlers. Right now, the system is very fixed that if you have effectively an IRQ, that IRQ gets one thread, and that thread handles all the requests for that IRQ, and it's all a one-to-one relationship, and that's kind of it. You don't have any opportunity for more concurrency. You can't have a pool of threads service an IRQ, for example. You can't have multiple IRQs share a thread or things of that nature. And finally, one of the things when we added filters, and even before when they weren't called filters in FreeBSD 4, they were called fast interrupts, we basically don't try at all to handle the race condition that if you have a filter running when you try to remove it, we just say that the remove worked, and we don't check to see if the filter was running. We actually don't have a way to do that. So that was one of the other things that I wished to fix. So the way that I've done this, and I've gone through several iterations, and this is kind of the current one that I've hashed out with some discussions with Jeff and some other folks. I've added a new data structure that I call an interrupt queue. It's kind of like a specialized task queue for interrupt handlers. And if you can imagine where we used to have an IRQ that might have a list of handlers at the top, and it would schedule an iThread to run, and the iThread would run over the various handlers for that IRQ. The interrupt queue is kind of something in the middle that when interrupt happens, an IRQ will kind of dump handlers into the queue, and then you might have one or more threads at the bottom that then pull things out of the queue and execute them. So one of the things this requires is that interrupt handlers now have a full state machine of like five or six different states that they iterate through. This also allows us to fix the problem that we can't safely handle tearing down an interrupt filter when we deregister an interrupt handler. The handlers are now tied to a queue rather than to a thread. So you can have multiple threads effectively service an IRQ because multiple threads can service a queue. You can also have multiple IRQs feed into a single interrupt queue. That's very confusing because IRQ and queue. So multiple interrupt events or interrupt sources can feed into a single interrupt queue. So you can kind of, if you wish, have a fan in and then a fan out. Have a picture later that might make that a little more obvious. And so I guess more of these points are about effectively divorcing those things. As I said, you can have multiple pool of threads associate pull off a single queue. The threads themselves will only pull from a single queue. You can't have a thread that spans queues. So here's a kind of picture. This is a little busy. So an interrupt event is a data structure we have in the kernel that represents a source of interrupts, like typically an IRQ, but we also use this for software interrupts. And an interrupt event has a list of handlers. And when an interrupt fires today, or in this new system, today is fairly similar. When an interrupt fires, we walk all the list of handlers to see if they have a filter or not. If they have a filter, we ask the filter if the handler should be queued. Otherwise, we assume, yes, your interrupt handler should be queued. So the fact that we will always walk all the lists and always queue all the handlers fixes the original problem with interrupt filters, where we would not always schedule all the handlers. So from here, the handlers that are queued for execution kind of follow this line to the top of the queue. And then you can have one or more interrupt threads that all pull events off the queue, execute them, and that's it. There is a new API that can optionally, which is what this kind of differently dashed line at the top represents, an interrupt handler can now optionally requeue itself for execution. So we have some drivers currently do this in a hackish way with the kind of fast task queues that we have. IGB will do this, that if it decides it's run long enough, there's a RX processing limit, syscall you can set, it will not re-enable interrupts in the hardware, and will throw itself back on the back of the task queue. And so this is very similar in concept, that you can choose to not re-enable interrupts in your hardware, and you can throw yourself at the back of your interrupt queue, which means that if you have multiple very busy devices that are sharing a queue, then they can, by using this means of limiting how many packets or whatever items they'll process per execution, they can cooperatively timeshare, if that makes sense. So as I said, another feature. One of the things I ran into while trying to convert IGB to use this scheme, because that was my test case for fleshing out things I'd missed, in some cases the filter or fast jump handler for IGB wants us to schedule a different task. It splits out handling RX and TX separately from handling link status changes. So I also added the ability with that the same API that a handler can reschedule itself. Instead of a filter, you can actually create a special type of interrupt handler it's called a manual handler. It's not automatically scheduled when an IRQ fires, but a filter can optionally choose to schedule it when it wishes it to fire. And for IGB, I use this for the link status handler. So that potentially you can actually schedule multiple threaded interrupt handlers that will run in the queue when a single interrupt fires. And as I mentioned earlier, the handlers can be scheduled themselves, which can be used to implement the cooperative polling. And in general, this model has much greater flexibility between IRQs and threads. So I guess to clarify that a bit more, in the current implementation, because I'm still getting this working and I have a more limited version that I hope to get into 9, it's still one-to-one that an interrupt event is bound to a single queue, is bound to a thread. But the data structures are in place to make it so that you could glue the pieces together a little differently. You can have multiple, you can have a pool of threads, or you could bind 3 or 4 IRQs to a single interrupt queue, bind that queue to 2 or 3 CPUs and bind 3 or 4 threads to that queue. And you can kind of split your workload that way. But basically, it allows you to pull together however you want. One of my original designs for hardware interrupts that was tried to be tied very closely to what Jeff had done for his vendor customer, he actually had the queue be per CPU. And so I originally had the queue for hardware interrupts actually be tied to the CPU. It could still be made that way. But now it could be more flexible in that you could have it span CPUs or whatever you wish to do. Yes, Joe?
So you want it to be that flexible?
Say what? Yes. So I haven't got all the pieces in place to allow you to create more threads, but the data structures are in place, and it's mostly a matter of what kind of APIs do we expose. In the case of vendors who take this code, they can also add their own APIs in the kernel or outside to do even more creative things than stock FreeBSD might do. But it does give you a little bit more of a toolkit, but I believe the implementation does not make it any less efficient than the current one.
Do all the threads associated with the queue have the same priority?
Yes, currently. So that is a good question about priority that I've somewhat punted on. So I believe in the case of Solaris, the way their queues work is that they have a queue per priority level, and I currently don't quite do that. But that is an option that could be done without tearing the code up too much. But these data structures would mostly support that, in which case, if you were to have a queue per priority level, then you could have a network queue and a storage queue if an IRQ is shared between the two things and have different pools of threads service the network interrupts versus the storage interrupts. That is probably fine as long as you're using something like MSI where you don't need to mask things in an APIC. It will still work the way I'd use reference counts to know when to unmask the APIC if you do it when you're using an APIC, but I think it'll be far less beneficial because you'll still be constrained on you have to let everybody execute before you can re-enable the interrupt in the APIC again. But in the case of MSI, that flexibility might very well be useful, and that's something that could be, I think this could be rather easily extended to do that. So the current implementation, as I mentioned before, it has all the data structures in place, but I don't have all the bits to make it super flexible yet. Partly I was trying to get something originally that would work. When I had first posted patches where the queues were still tied to the CPU and there was a global pool of iThreads, many folks were upset that you could no longer see which IRQs are busy in top. So and this current implementation is now back to the mode by default where every IRQ has a single iThread in top, and you can still see them, and it looks just like it does now. But it does fix filters, which is one of my key original goals, and it gives us the flexibility to do more creative things in the future. And as I said, I don't currently have the code in place to allow you to pull it apart and create alternative topologies, but that's something that we can expand on in the future. It's something that, if this were to go into 9 in its current state, we could merge back, but it wouldn't be something that would break the ABI. Currently, the code is in a perforce branch. It's a little stale in that I haven't synced up with some of the changes Jeff did for InfiniBand to add an inter-drain hook, so I'll have to re-implement that. But other than that, it should fairly well apply to 9. There are some minor issues with a few drivers. I have a patch I sent out to Warner a long time ago to fix an issue with PC card. That PC card abuses the interrupt filters in a way that is not supported in the new code. And but aside from that, that's about the only really major one. This is something I think I would like to get into 9. And I think the current new version of it is something that I can more successfully sell this time, since top still looks the same. And I think that's all I had for interrupt queues. Does anybody have any questions? So I think it can give you possible steps to get there, but it doesn't give you that all by itself. So in the case of what Jeff had done for his vendor, he did the work to have network interfaces around Robin and a layer on the network stack itself. And then I believe you could build that on top of this just fine based on the discussions I've had with him and what we've talked about. But all I currently provide is the ability for that each driver has to manage requeuing itself. So you can imagine a wrapper layer around the driver's interrupt handler that, for certain standardized type of interfaces, could do the same thing. Using the underlying API we use for interrupts. As far as allowing you to actually allow user line to run, that is not something that currently allows. The interrupt queue is still going to run with an iThread priority. So if you have a constant storm of interrupts, it's not going to allow non-interrupt code to work. There's not a currently a concept for having a built-in delay where you don't actually schedule it for a while. That is something that could be implemented. I'd have to think about how you would do that and have it not, how you could do that safely and performantly. But the current design does not aim to do that. And none of the current drivers we have in the tree aim to do that either. They only really aim to attempt to, on their task queue, be cooperative. But in many cases, they create private task queues, so in effect, it is never cooperative, with the exception that their task queues are on different threads. But I think that the current systems are less cooperative. They're also, for example, the IGB driver now can get into the very unfortunate case where sometimes the MSI interrupt handler will choose to reschedule the task queue to service more events. And if you're under heavy load, you can have the task queue handler running against an IGB queue and the interrupt handler running in the iThread against the same IGB queue, and they both sit there trying to service the same queue and fighting over the locks constantly with each other and eating up a lot of CPU. In this case, because there is the interrupt handler can only be executed by one thread at a time, it will never get into that case. If you try to schedule the queue, the interrupt while it's already running, its state moves into a re-queue me now state, and when the interrupt handler finishes, the thread that's executing the handler will then throw it in the back of the queue. So it avoids the problem of having the same thing executing twice on two different threads. Any other questions? Julian? Yes.
How are you synchronizing? You just have a spin lock there?
Yes. And we currently use a spin lock to schedule the thread. And it's what I've actually done is the thread that's on the queue, I now use as when an interrupt thread goes to sleep, it can use the thread from the queue as its thread lock. If you're familiar with how the thread lock stuff works in current, where we can change the lock pointer for the thread. So it actually means that even though you're taking that lock, we don't have to switch to a different lock to schedule the thread to run. The same lock that we would have taken before that would have been a kind of dummy lock, because normally it was left as a weird lock in effect, because we never explicitly set a thread lock for iThreads when they're idle. You're just replacing which one it requires that's idle. So it's the same number of lock acquisitions, if that makes sense. Just as we reuse the lock on a sleep queue or a turnstile for the thread when it's blocked on that state, when an iThread is idle, we use the lock from the interrupt queue it's associated with as its thread lock at that time. So that allows us to avoid that, to have the center of lock acquisitions, even though we're now using the lock to protect this state of the number. And the lock purely protects the list of handlers in the queue. And once the thread, one advantage of the queue approach is you no longer, when you're tearing down the thread, the iThread itself doesn't walk the list of handlers in the interrupt event. Only the actual code when interrupt fires, it schedules events to happen. So that feeds into how I can now manage thread teardown to be a little safer than it used to be. Yes?
How does this play with MSIX when you've got multiple vectors coming off the same device?
So the way that works currently in FreeBSD and would still work now is every MSIX and MSI vector is basically an entirely separate inter-event and inter-source. So right now they all have their own threads. you could conceivably tie them into a single queue if you wish to, or you could, I mean, that's part of the how you go together. But in the current, both then now and the current stuff and what the current patches are that mimic the current stuff, they still all have their own threads and are completely independent. That's also true if you have, even in the non-MSIX case, and you know, simple MSI, if you have multiple messages, they're all still actually independent.
Hi, John, I have a question.
Yes.
So historically, we've used the iThread mechanism for soft interrupt stuff as well as hard interrupt stuff. And
yes.
In previous D8 and 9, we kind of move away from that in the network stack. Do you anticipate that we might use your new interrupt queue stuff for soft iThready stuff, or not so much?
Well, all the current software interrupt threads do use this queue stuff the same exact way. If it remains suitable, I'm happy for them to use that. But if it's mostly geared towards making hardware interrupts work well. It is less clear how well software tasks fit into that. There are many, not just the network stack, but many other places now just use a dedicated thread or a dedicated task queue thread to implement what would, in effect, be software thread tasks in the past. So it's less clear that... Yes.
A question that actually has to do with load balancing, affinity, and that kind of thing. So on these high-performance network OLEDs, you have the ability to provide instructions to the card to rebalance load information, to provide affinity, and that kind of thing. How do you see that kind of fitting into this model as well? You need a feedback mechanism to tell the device driver when to reconfigure things and when to rebalance load.
I'm not sure how if you could have that be generic enough to actually live in the interrupt layer as opposed to somewhere else, such as in the network layer where I know that I've processed more packets on this queue than the other, and so I should rebalance the load based on that, if that makes sense.
It's kind of interesting how to tie into the schedule, sorry. I guess the question is, when should you rebalance load? Does it have to do with your productivity with respect to packets or the availability of CPU for whatever is running at your priority? And it seems like it's likely that similar requirements will turn up for other kinds of devices than network devices in the future. I mean, we keep talking about the storage stack as something that needs to deal with high transactions per second, and we might expect that similar things will happen there.
So I'm not comfortable saying that I think there's a general solution. At least I cannot think of one. For example, in the storage stack, I think even more so because you have the potential for, if you have a smart HBA that's going to reorder things, it is much harder to reason exactly. In the case of a NIC, you typically are putting things into a bunch of FIFO queues, and you kind of explicitly know what the load is on the different queues, and you have to be very explicit about your scheduling. But in the case of the HBAs I'm familiar with, you tend to not have a bunch of queues, but instead you send commands with barriers, and the storage controller itself internally might have a bunch of queues that it is free to split work among and reorder. And which is not something that the OS has a lot of visibility into, aside from setting barriers when there are certain operations that must be ordered.
So the last question I have has to do with CPUs arriving and going away. Does the framework currently have any facility for just dealing with that kind of thing in principle? I mean, NetISR doesn't, and also deals with all the threads. So I'm kind of trying to decide, you know, should I be reworking NetISR to deal with the basis that you might provide those kinds of facilities that might be just respond to events as opposed to try to handle framework?
So, in the older version of this, when interrupt queues were tied to CPUs, that would have been something that would have needed to be handled. In this case, I'm not sure it's something that would be require specific handling in the iThreads themselves. In the case of you taking a CPU away or adding a new CPU, at the low-level code where we develop, for example, in x86, which 8-bit vector do we route an interrupt to? That is something that will have to be aware of CPUs coming and going, and something that will have to be addressed, but that is going to be something that's machine dependent and mostly independent of the interrupt code itself. As far as the actual scheduling of the threads, that is kind of a problem that because we use CPU sets to manage the binding of even iThreads to CPUs, that's something that will be handled generically in the scheduler when we decide how we handle pinned and bound CPUs in the scheduler when a CPU goes away. So I'm not sure it's something that will be very... Yes.
There are going to be choices about affinity on data structures. They know those packs will be associated with. The kind of problem you run into is like, you know, deep in the Chelsea driver, it says things coming up, but it knows there are a bunch of hardware keys. How many threads, iThreads, should be created? What should the affinity of those iThreads be? And how should
Well, the other thing that I would caution based on my experience is in many cases, the kernel doesn't know best. And in many cases, what we instead wish to provide is the ability for USLAN to set various policies, as the system in many cases actually does know exactly how the system is going to be used, especially for specialized workloads, and are in the best position to determine how resources should be distributed and pinned. So for example, in many cases, you actually don't want to use multiple queues in the kernel for a 10 gig NIC for whatever reason. So. Right.
The issue is that then the I-threads need to have the right affinity. We'll arrange for the college to deliver the data to the right I-thread, right? But we need to make sure the I-thread is running in the right place.
That I think is fairly easy to arrange, especially implicitly right now with the API that we provide to device drivers in the form of busbind enter. When you do a busbind enter, you're going to effectively pin your interrupt event and your associated thread to that CPU right then, and we can allow that to still continue to be true. And in the case of, if you wish to be more flexible and actually create a dedicated queue that spans multiple RQs, then that will be, it will require more work to get right. And I think in some cases that might require help from the sysadmin to hit what they think the right answer should be. But in the current default case of each RQ has a dedicated thread, that will just work based on the hinting when the device driver calls busbind enter, just as it does today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay. How am I on time? What are we supposed to be done?
2:30, right?
Is that what we're supposed to be done? Because it says 2:30 there.
I'm looking at the calendar. It says 2:30 is when we're supposed to be done.
Okay. Then I will not do my other little talk. Okay. Thank you.